For decades, the federal student loan program has paid private lenders and banks a subsidy for loans they make to college students. The Obama administration wants to bypass banks. It would have the federal government lend directly to students. Some schools have already switched to direct lending, and NPR's Claudio Sanchez explains why.
$8 billion worth of student loans dried up in the last 10 months of 2008 as some of the nation's biggest banks and state guarantors of student loans either scaled down or stopped making loans altogether. Across the country, students and their parents didn't know what was going on.
At the rate many lenders were leaving the program, how certain could that parent be that that lender might be there for them that year, but what would happen the following year?
Nobody knew, says Anna Griswold, director of financial aid at Penn State University. But at the time, she says, 40,000 students were in danger of losing access to federal loans. Eventually, other lenders stepped in, and most students got their money. But by then, says Griswold,
it was very clear and a no-brainer as to what made the most sense for us here at Penn State.
What Penn State did was switch from the Federal Family Education Loan Program, which depends heavily on private lenders, to the direct lending program run by the U.S. Department of Education. Penn State was not alone. In the last year, over 500 colleges have made that switch. For good reason, says Robert Shireman, Deputy Undersecretary of Education.
We can be sure that the families, the students who need loans, will have them available when they need the funds. And we won't have a last-minute problem of a lender pulling out because of something that's maybe happened in the stock market or in credit markets.
Reliability, says Anna Griswold, is the biggest difference now that Penn State is a direct lending institution. The switch, she says, was simple. For students, little has changed. The financial aid office certifies a student's eligibility for federal aid online, processes the application, and sends it to the U.S. Department of Education via a secure system online. But opponents of direct lending say the Penn State example does not address a bigger issue.
To me, it boils down to competition and choice.
John Dean is special counsel to the Consumer Bankers Association. He says about 2,000 private lenders and banks today participate in the federal student loan program. Replacing them with a single lender, the federal government, would destroy competition and choice. Besides, says Dean, colleges have had the option to switch to direct lending since 1994. So why have 8 out of 10 schools chosen not to?
They obviously think that the customer service is going to be better.
The Education Department's Robert Shireman disagrees. He says this is all about creating a more efficient, cheaper way of lending money to students.
We can't afford to spend the money for an institution to choose something that costs taxpayers more.
Shireman says once private lenders are out of the picture, the $8 to $10 billion in subsidies the government has been paying them will go back into federal aid for students. The House of Representatives has already voted in favor of direct lending. It'll soon come up for a vote in the Senate, where passage is less certain. But the administration is so confident it will pass, the Education Department has drawn up plans to issue all loans through the direct lending program beginning next summer. Claudio Sanchez, NPR News.
Metropolitan Archives in suburban Maryland is a rarity in the business world these days. It's a small business that's expanding. The family-owned paper warehouse has gotten some help from government loan programs, and it was the backdrop today for President Obama as he announced new efforts to make credit more widely available to small businesses. NPR's Scott Horsley has that story.
Joe Incarnato started Metropolitan Archives, along with a fraternity brother, 5 years ago and turned an empty warehouse into a bustling business. He's managed to weather the recession, employ 10 people, and before long he's hoping to hang out the Help Wanted sign again.
We have been fortunate to take our small family-operated business and turn it into a successful company.
Earlier this year, Incarnato was able to buy the building he's in with a loan backed by the Small Business Administration. As part of its stimulus effort, the federal government cut fees for SBA loans and boosted guarantees. Since then, SBA loan volumes have rebounded by 70% from their recession low. Even so, President Obama says there's still too little credit flowing to small businesses.
There's still too many entrepreneurs who can't get the loans they need to open up their doors and start hiring. There's still too many who are struggling to make payroll and to stay open, and there are still too many successful small businesses that want to expand further and hire more but just don't have the capital to do it.
The president announced plans to make it cheaper for community banks to lend to small businesses using money from the government's bank bailout fund. He also endorsed legislation that would let the SBA guarantee bigger loans to help small businesses grow.
These companies are the engine of job growth in America. They fuel our prosperity. And that's why they have to be at the forefront of our recovery.
Community bankers welcome the administration's move, but it's not clear how much of a difference it will make. Chief Economist Paul Mirsky of the Independent Community Bankers of America says even with the new discount, bailout funds are an expensive source of capital, and the government's money comes with a lot of strings attached. What's more, he says, both bankers and borrowers are cautious about piling up debt when the economic recovery is still uncertain.
It's not only accessing capital, but it's the regulators allowing banks to do additional loans, and it's also creating an economic environment where there's a demand for quality loans out there.
Still, the Obama administration is eager to show that its financial rescue efforts extend beyond Wall Street. On a day when Wells Fargo reported quarterly earnings of $2.6 billion and Morgan Stanley set aside $5 billion for year-end bonuses, White House spokesman Robert Gibbs says the financial recovery must be more widely shared.
We've seen progress in some sectors, but the president continues to hear daily from small businesses that are still struggling to get access.
As it shifts its attention to small business, the administration is starting to wind down some other parts of the bank bailout. At a fundraiser in New York City last night, Mr. Obama scolded Wall Street for accepting bailout money, then fighting the regulatory changes he's proposed to prevent another financial meltdown. Mr. Obama said when Wall Street is profiting, but small businesses are struggling, it's a sign that people have forgotten we're all in this together. Scott Horsley, NPR News, the White House.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
And now we turn from baseball to monkey business. Most groundbreaking experiments in economics are performed by economists, as you would expect. But a scientist called a primate ethologist has added to the sum total of economic knowledge, at least as it applies to monkeys, and maybe to us. Alex Bloomberg of our Planet Money team has the story.
You're on the low end of the social order. You toil and toil, yet make hardly any money for your efforts. Is there a way for you to improve your lot, bump up your earning potential, if you're a monkey?
We were trying to answer questions about whether monkeys are able to behave in an economic way.
This is Dr. Ronald Noe, a primate ethologist at the University of Strasbourg. His question specifically was, what would happen if he trained a low-ranking vervet monkey to do things that other vervet monkeys, even high-ranking monkeys, couldn't do? Now, vervet monkey society is pretty hierarchical. High-ranking monkeys get groomed a lot, but hardly ever have to groom other monkeys. Low-ranking monkeys groom others, but never get groomed themselves. Dr. Noe's team trained a low-ranker to open a container with bits of apples in it, a skill that no other monkey had. Would it be worth anything, he wondered, in monkey money, otherwise known as grooming?
It has some aspects of money. The high rankers can give other services that lower rankers can't give, such as support in a fight or a tolerance around a food site or something like that. And they get rewarded for that by grooming often.
I see. Okay. Tolerance around the food site. In other words, they can
decide whether or not a lower ranker is allowed to feed next to them or not. If they don't like it, they hit him over the head. If they like it, they...
So it's a protection racket in a certain way.
We see it in a slightly more positive way. They're nice to each other and groom each other. But of course, they also hit each other over the head once in a while. That's for sure.
Sure enough, when they trained a low-ranking monkey to open the container, just as any technical college advertisement will tell you, the new skills translated into a higher income. Roughly an hour after she'd opened the container for everyone, she was getting groomed a lot more, as much as a high-ranking monkey, and she no longer had to do hardly any grooming herself. But that was not the most spectacular finding.
So what we then did is we got a second low-ranking female, trained her to open a second container with apples in it. And then we saw that the value of the first provider dropped more or less to the half of what she had before. So now we had a competition between two animals. Both of them could provide this good, so these apples. And so the value of the first one dropped down again. And of the second one, who was very low at the beginning of the experiment, she went up and they ended up both in the middle, so to speak.
So when there was a monkey monopoly on this skill, the monkeys paid one price. But when it became a duopoly, the price fell to an equilibrium point, about half of what it had been. And this all happened despite the fact that we're talking about monkeys here. Monkeys can't do math.
Animals that cannot form binding contracts, animals that cannot talk about what they want to do or cannot offer verbally or anything, they nevertheless are quite accurate in adapting their behavior to what the market gives them.
Dr. Noe says that monkeys arrive at these economic outcomes not through sitting down and negotiation, but through feeling and emotion. Monkeys develop positive associations towards a container-opening member of their society, and they just want to groom her. But once another monkey can open the container, the skill isn't as unique, the positive feelings diminish, and grooming goes down. It's the law of supply and demand played out along the neurohormonal pathways that deal with emotion in the monkey brain. Dr. Noe wonders how much of human economics operates along similar lines. As he puts it, even on the stock market, people might play more with their bellies than with their brains. For NPR News, I'm Alex Blumberg.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Alyssa Block in California.
And I'm Michelle Norris in Washington. First up this hour, we have a story that begins with some old-time potions promised cures for just about any ailment. And it ends with our modern-day healthcare system. It is a story of how we wound up with a system where employers pay for health insurance.
So how did we get here? After all, employers don't pay for our groceries or our gas. NPR's Planet Money has been exploring this question, and as Adam Davidson and Alex Blumberg discovered, there was never any central logic at work, just a bunch of accidents that brought us to where we are today.
To learn about how we got our modern healthcare system, you do have to study history, but you don't have to study too much of it. You can ignore most of what was going on before, say, the 1920s.
That's right, Adam. We dug up some archival healthcare radio stories. Here's a bit.
You know that unless some relief comes to you, that you're going to be in the undertaker's parlor on the old cold slab being embalmed for a funeral. Well, why do you hold back? Why do you twist?
The audio quality isn't great, so let me explain. This is Dr. John Brinkley, and he was huge in the U.S. in the 1920s, dispensing on-air health advice through his radio shows. Whatever problem folks had, he had one fabulous solution: transplant a goat gland into your body. It was perfect for everything from dementia to impotence to flatulence.
And if, somehow, a goat gland didn't cure your ills, you could always use Bonor's electromagnetic bathing fluid, Clark Stanley's snake oil liniment.
Oh, and my personal favorite, mugwump, for the cure and prevention of all venereal disease.
We're having fun here, of course, but the point is that up until, say, 1910, 1920, most medical care in the U.S. was basically medieval, a bunch of potions that did nothing.
Luckily, they were cheap potions. Healthcare was a trivial part of the average person's annual budget. In 1900, the average American spent $5 a year on healthcare. That was cheap even then, $100 in today's dollars.
So it was a trade-off. On the one hand, healthcare was cheap. That's a big plus over the system we have today. On the other hand, it didn't actually make you any better.
Right. And of course, nobody had health insurance. Why would you get health insurance for something that doesn't work and only costs $5 a year?
So, the first step in getting us to our current healthcare system, medicine got better. Doctors started curing the sick.
There were new and, for the first time, effective medicines starting in the 1910s and 20s, especially antibiotics. There was also a medical school revolution.
All this transformed healthcare, which was especially clear in hospitals. Before, say, 1911, hospitals were not anything like what we think of today. They were really poorhouses where the indigent went to die.
Melissa Thomason is an economic historian at Miami University in Ohio.
Hospitals have a radical transformation in the early part of the 20th century. Hospitals are actually marketing themselves as places to have babies, do appendectomies, take your tonsils out. They're focusing on generally things with happy outcomes.
Turns out, effective healthcare is a lot more expensive than quack elixirs. All these clean hospitals, educated doctors, real pharmacological research, it costs money.
People were willing to pay when they were really sick, but it wasn't yet common to just go to the doctor for checkups or for a survivable illness.
By the late 1920s, hospitals noticed most of their beds were going empty every night. They wanted to get people who weren't deathly ill to start coming in.
An official at Baylor University Hospital in Dallas, Texas, noticed that Americans, on average, were spending more on cosmetics than on medical care. He said, "We spend a dollar or so at a time for cosmetics and do not notice the high cost. The ribbon counter clerk can pay 50 cents, 75 cents, or a dollar a month, yet it would take about 20 years to set aside a large hospital bill."
So Baylor Hospital wanted to figure out how to get ribbon counter clerks and anyone else they could find in Dallas to pay for health care like they pay for lipstick, a tiny bit every month.
Baylor started small. They offered a deal to a group of public school teachers in Dallas. They told them, "You pay us 50 cents a month and we'll cover your hospital visits."
And then the Depression hit. Almost every hospital in the country saw their patient load disappear, so the Baylor idea became hugely popular and eventually got a name, Blue Cross. Again, Melissa Thomason.
You know, when I actually started studying this stuff, I got interested in it because I wondered why we have an employment-based health insurance plan. It doesn't seem very logical, but it comes right out of Blue Cross selling insurance to groups of people who probably wouldn't need it, that is, people who were healthy enough to work. The genius in marketing this by Blue Cross is marketing it to groups of workers.
Blue Cross eventually shows up in almost every state, but it's still pretty small. Not that many people have it. To get to our modern insurance system, you need another step. Go to war.
War has always had two fronts. The fighting front with its fury of battle, and behind the lines, the civilian front with its job of living and producing.
The war economy is an entirely different ballgame.
Economic historian Melissa Thomason says that if the Great Depression inadvertently inspired employer-based health insurance, World War II accidentally spread the idea everywhere.
Essentially, we go from being a mixed economy with mostly market and some government intervention to being a planned economy. I mean, think of government rationing on all levels.
Good afternoon. Here's a reminder from the Office of Price Administration. All old type B and C gas coupons expire midnight August 31st. That's Tuesday night.
What they tell people is you legally cannot raise prices, you can't raise wages. And so you can't find workers who can work for you. You can't lure them by increasing wages. You know, so what's a poor employer to do? They turn to fringe benefits. And they just started offering more and more generous health insurance plans.
Then another big change, the one that really cemented the system and got us where we are today. It came entirely by accident in 1943.
The Internal Revenue Service ruled that employer-based health care should be tax-free. Then, in 1954, a new law made the tax advantage of employer-based health care even more attractive.
And if you don't think a tax law change can have a huge impact on health care, Melissa Thomason has some data for you, pal. Just look at how the number of people with employer-based health insurance changed over time.
You start from 9% of the population in 1940 to 63% of the population in 1953.
Wow.
I mean, everybody starts getting in on it. It just grows like gangbusters. And by the 1960s, you know, roughly 70% of the population is covered by some kind of private, what the AMA would say, voluntary health insurance plan.
By the mid-1960s, Thomason says, Americans started to see our system, where people with good jobs get health care through work and people without good jobs have to look to the government as if it were the natural order of things.
To Thomason and other economic historians, though, there's nothing natural or inevitable about it. It's simply the result of a series of historical accidents. I'm Alex Bloomberg.
And I'm Adam Davidson, NPR News.